Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo, Egypt, for an update on the violent clashes between the angry supporters of ousted President Morsi and the military that toppled him. A political activist engaged in the first and now the second revolution underway, Sherif Geber, a member of the Morrisine Independent Media Collective, joins us to explain the battles in the streets and the prospects for a restoration of Egyptian democracy with all sides participating. Then we will speak with Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. We will discuss the recent close vote on stopping the NSA from spying on Americans and the apparent gulf between the public and the political establishment on the government's intrusion into our civil liberties. We will also discuss the fate of Edward Snowden and whether the White House is using the cancellation of Obama's September visit to Russia as leverage to get Putin to hand over Snowden. And then finally, we'll speak with Tom Herschel, a professor of sociology at Cornell University and director of the Population and Development Program. We will discuss a new report that he worked on for the Associated Press that finds 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggling with joblessness and near poverty in an economy in which Obama says the income gap is fraying America's social fabric. And joining us now from Cairo is Sherif Geber, who's a member of the Morrisine Independent Media Collective in Cairo, where he researches housing rights and social justice issues. And you are in the midst, of course, of Revolution 2, and there was an enormous amount of violence last night, particularly on the October 6th bridge, where a number of supporters of the ousted President Morsi left their encampment in Nasser City, marched towards the city, and then there was a shootout. I guess most of the shooting obviously came from the army and the police. They claim, of course, that some of the Islamists shot at them, but there are over 70 people killed. So this is beginning to look like Egypt's future is looking increasingly dark.
I think that we have to remember that this isn't the first time that security forces have perpetrated an atrocity like this. Of course, the scale here is huge. It's one of the biggest instances of violence we've seen from police. But then again, you know, it's not the first time that police or army have just free-fired on demonstrators. It's definitely troubling. I mean, in some ways, we've been feeling, many of us, that we're caught between military fascism and brotherhood fascism for some time now. But at the same time, I think the truth will come out, and I think that we are going to have to continue, because there's really to fall into the trap of either kind of cowering behind the military or jumping to raise the brotherhood up as heroes simply because they've been so heinously attacked, I think is nothing that we need to do politically. We need to continue on rejecting this kind of cycle of state violence that the Brotherhood used just as much as the army is now using when they were in power, and agitating for alternative futures.
Well, isn't that the irony, though, here, Sherif Geber, that Mohamed Morsi has been transformed from a tone-deaf, incompetent, boneheaded leader to a hero of the Islamic cause?
I think that he remains a tone-deaf and incompetent leader. But the Islamists, particularly the Brotherhood, had always supported him and always denied the allegations of his incompetency. And I think that it's very easy to oppose what happened and oppose this sort of police violence without raising up Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood as heroes or as anyone who warrants our support beyond seeing that the police isn't allowed to attack them in the street.
But Sherif Geber, the protesters that poured into Tahrir Square yesterday, hundreds of thousands, were holding up portraits of their favorite general, General Sisi. So he appears to be a hero amongst many. Now, you're a part of the younger generation who brought about the original revolution. Is this an awkward bedfellow that you have?
He's no bedfellow at all, I'd say. I mean, the people who came into Tahrir Square raising portraits of Sisi, many of them, of course, were scared by the kind of propaganda and media frenzy that turned the Brotherhood from, you know, as we saw, a very violent and incompetent party ruling the country into some sort of boogeyman. I mean, this is an intentional move by the army and by military intelligence to raise up Sisi as a kind of charismatic figure, although I don't see where the charisma comes from. So I think that a lot of people are doing this out of hatred of the Brotherhood, whether that's rational or contributed to by the way that the media has been really shamefully behaving. And on the other hand, we, you know, those of us who've been fighting out in the streets for this revolution over the past 2.5 years have very few illusions about the military, about the military's true goals, and about the military's true position as a core and enormous part of the old regime that itself cannot be allowed to continue the way it is. And I should think that the current fervor aside, we have to come out of this opposing both, again, the Brotherhood and the military in order to really see the change that I think everyone in Egypt truly wants.
And again, I'm speaking with Sharif Geber, who is in Cairo, Egypt. He's a member of the Mousserine Independent Media Collective, where his work and research focuses on housing rights and social justice issue. And we're talking about the second revolution underway, and particularly the violence that was meted out against a demonstration of supporters of the imprisoned leader, Mohamed Morsi, of course, ironically, the first democratically elected leader of Egypt, who a large part of the population rejected, and the army brought about a coup. Of course, many people don't want to call it a coup, but I've been trying to cover what was behind this takeover. And you remember, of course, when Sisi announced the takeover, he was standing next to representatives of the Al-Nur party, the Salafists, the very conservative Islamists. So where does that stand now, the alliances here? You've got on the moderate side, for the want of a better description, you've got Mohamed al-Baradei condemning the excessive use of force. Al-Nur appears to be very silent. And I guess the broader question is the role of Saudi Arabia in funding this latest revolution. So is it possible, Sharif, that the young revolutionaries like yourself are going to have the revolution stolen again?
Well, you know, I think that to say that we've had one revolution or two, or to say that we've had a revolution stolen in its entirety is a misnomer. I mean, we've been involved, I think, in one very long revolutionary sequence that began on the 25th of January in 2011, if not sooner, and has continued. We've seen the army, yes, definitely, attempting to co-opt popular energies and play on people's fears and use their own strength to bully people into accepting their role in power and politics. But to say that they've entirely stolen it is not true, because we saw people come out, continue to demonstrate against military rule, and we will see that again. We saw people demonstrating against the Brotherhood. I mean, there is an opposition that will continue until the demands of the revolution are met, because these are basic social justice demands that, you know, people won't stop until they see a substantive change happening in their daily lives, you know, dignity, freedom, and social justice. And, you know, as far as the Salafis go, you know, the Nur party is just one of the most incredible opportunists that I've seen. I mean, they've entered into this, I think, under the notion that some Islamists would be able to help the coalition keep legitimacy, but at the same time, they're acting as spoilers, and I think that they don't really have any interest in the revolution. They simply have an interest in kind of recouping the power that the Muslim Brotherhood lost. So I don't see much of a future for them, whether it's even within the coalition, which they're continually spoiling, or, you know, hopefully in Egypt's politics, because they don't represent a way forward and a real change in the economy or in our daily life.
But apparently before this coup, there were tremendous shortages, gasoline shortages, long lines, bread, etc. And there is an assumption that because suddenly $12 billion appeared from the Gulf and from Saudi Arabia, The Saudis were the first to congratulate Sisi. Gasoline suddenly showed up in the gas stations, and the police, who have never been on the streets for the longest time, suddenly show up and start directing traffic. So one can have a suspicion that there's an outside role in this as well. How much do you feel there is an outside role between, you know, in a way, a proxy role between the Qataris who supported the Muslim Brotherhood and through Al Jazeera, which is apparently quite unpopular in Egypt, and then the Saudis, who apparently were sabotaging the economy and now are rewarding the generals?
Well, you know, we had gasoline shortages, I mean, historically, once every once in a while. You know, they were nothing new, and I wouldn't adopt necessarily conspiratorial tone about that. And we've definitely seen Qatar on the one hand and Saudi Arabia on the other hand throwing money at their favored side as part of a proxy battle. But in the end, you know, they're supporting very reactionary elements, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or the old regime. You know, the Egyptian people aren't seeing this money or gaining the benefit of it. And I think that they're suspicious of it in either case. You know, so we're, of course, Egypt has a long history of imperialism working against it, and a long history of being a site of many proxy battles in the Middle East, particularly as relates to maintaining a certain status quo relationship with Israel for the U.S.'s sake. But, you know, we at the same time, I think, are going to have to continue to push for kind of independence on a revolutionary course. And, you know, daunting as the task may be, you know, I think it's the only way that we can continue to go, whether or not the kind of proxies wage.
So you've got, on the one hand, you've got an angry and dejected Muslim Brotherhood, whose leader has been imprisoned by this coup, and they seem to represent certainly the less economically advantaged Egyptians. And on the other side, you've got the generals who've always been around, and then you've got the Mubarak-era media that you were mentioning earlier. I imagine that's what you're referring to, that is demonizing the Brotherhood. So at this point, Sharif Geber, how do you see this thing being resolved? Because it, surely at the end of the day, the Muslim Brotherhood supporters have to be invited back into the democratic process. You can't have a repeat of what happened in Algeria. A lot of the Islamists believe that they will be excluded from democracy, and that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you believe in that adage that the Islamists only believe in one man, one vote, one time. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you deny them the democratic process. And after all, there's been a coup against their democratically elected leader.
I mean, sure. I mean, this is definitely the case. But to say that there's been a coup is not the same as saying that, you know, Morsi was a legitimate leader and the Muslim Brotherhood had legitimate rule. I mean, from the very beginning, we saw that the elections themselves took place under the military junta and, you know, were done in a questionable fashion and rushed, I think, to give this exact appearance of formal democratic procedure without really creating any change in the regime so as to make it a democratic system in a substantive way. I mean, and this is these are open questions, and the Muslim Brotherhood's own intransigence has definitely deepened the crisis, as have the military's sort of half-hearted calls for reconciliation. I think what we need to see is serious transitional justice. I think what we need to see is accountability for past crimes from all sides, but particularly the police and the army. The police, for instance, have really not even had to answer for the over 800 people killed in a single day, January 28, 2011, much less any of the other incidents of just gross and extreme violence we've seen, and same with the army. So this is something that I think, you know, if this government, this new government, is to show itself having any worth, it has to focus on a transitional justice project immediately. And unfortunately, it seems that they're just being puppeted by the military. So, you know, it could get it could get ugly before it gets better, unfortunately. But we have to keep pushing for what's right. This is a matter of principle and a matter of not siding with someone who is ultimately an enemy.
But how do you proceed then, Sherif Geber? If it's one group demonstrating in the streets, hundreds of thousands in favor of the generals, and hundreds of thousands in favor of the jailed Brotherhood leader Morsi, that is just a recipe for more street violence and more death. So what's happening in the alternative arena of negotiation? So you obviously can't negotiate with street demonstrations, tear gas, and shootings. There has to be an alternative form of negotiation, compromise and getting together and meeting. So give us a sense of where we're heading here. Are there any moves towards, you know, political compromise as opposed to a military confrontation?
I mean, you know, the civilian government, for whatever it's worth, has not really, has ostensibly been moving in this direction. But I think beyond that, I think what many of us are trying to do now is to find, to create initiatives that do expose the lies and the kind of violations from both sides, and at the same time push for a sort of third way, something that doesn't want to see return to either the Muslim Brotherhood or military rule, but at the same time wants to bring back, you know, basically all Egyptians and return this to the field of kind of political debate and political conflict. I mean, if you're asking me for specific mechanisms, this is something that, you know, we've been basically trying to just stay afloat of what's been happening. As you said, we're dealing with large numbers on either side, and we're dealing with a police force and an army who are kind of incredibly emboldened right now. But we have started small in the past. The movement against the military junta began with only a handful of people in 2011 and ended up kind of sweeping the country after a long period of organization and work. And so, you know, it is going to be similarly a time to attempt to invest and build in sort of any number of new initiatives to see which ones will stick and which ones will gain momentum. And I think that as each side, both the kind of intransigent and unpopular Muslim Brotherhood, and as that kind of army show their true colors and continue to deepen this crisis, people will be accepting alternatives, and people will want to see us moving back towards a real civilian revolutionary path.
And is the umbrella for that movement, is that still Tamarod? Is that, because that was financed by some of these big media oligarchs, wasn't it?
Well, you know, this did come out, but Tamarod actually, I mean, Tamarod started as a real, true grassroots movement. And I don't know the extent to which, I mean, you know, someone like Naguib Soweto to claim that he financed them, you know, is an arrogant man by nature, being the richest man in Egypt. And so I'm sure that in part he was trying to kind of just capitalize on the popularity of the campaign. And I'm sure he gave some money, but, you know, to say that he financed it, I think they had an office, and then they were printing out flyers. You know, this is a question. But also, Tamarod, we saw, has in many ways jumped on the pro-military bandwagon and collaborated with the military in ways that I think has turned off a lot of people who supported the original campaign. So it might not be Tamarod, but it might be other people like them. You know, it is similarly, I think, has to happen. Tamarod was totally unknown until they're collecting signatures on a university campus and were attacked by Brotherhood members. You know, this happens by accident as much as it does by preparation and intention. So we can't necessarily predict what will be the thing that catches on, but we can continue to work in different arenas to push for new campaigns and for new initiatives to start, of which some of them already have, and we'll see the amount of momentum that we can build beneath them.
Well, Sherif Geber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for being here.
Again, I've been speaking with Sharif Graber, who is a member of the Muracine Independent Media Collective in Cairo, where he researches on housing rights and social justice issues. He participated in the original revolution 2 years ago and in the subsequent revolution, which continues, as he pointed out. It is a long process, and it's worth remembering that the American Revolution didn't happen overnight as well, Sharif. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you again.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Steve Clemens about the fate of Edward Snowden.